Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Jim Ray Daniels. Jim Daniels' new collection of short fiction, Trigger Man, will be published by Michigan State University Press in fall 2011. MSU Press also published his most recent collection, Mr. Pleasant, in 2007. The title story of that book was turned into an independent film written and produced by Daniels that debuted at the Three Rivers Film Festival in November 2010. His most recent book of poems include Having a Little Talk with Capital P Poetry, Carnegie Mellon University Press, and From Milltown to Malltown, a collaborative book with photographs from Merrick Press. Welcome to Prosody, Jim.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
How about we start out with you reading a little bit tonight?
Sure. I'd like to read from Mr. Pleasant, beginning of a story called United States Street Football. The flat, crumbling streets of our subdivision were laid out in a basic, unimaginative grid, except for the odd twist where Rome Street turned into Pearl Street and vice versa, crisscrossing like the passing routes we ran in the middle of the street in front of our house on Rome. We played two-hand shove, not two-hand touch. This was in large part due to Angelo Diogenes' habitual protestation of, "You only got me one hand." Our only alternative was to shove him into a parked car or, if he was lucky, over the curb onto the grass in order to emphasize the second hand. But the day Angelo was hit by Pete Baroni's speeding Pontiac Firebird and slow-mowed his way up into the air and bounced off the windshield as Pete swerved and kept going, a police car in hot pursuit, we had to change the rules once again and forever. The Free Press reported that the accident occurred on Pearl, and of course they were wrong. No reporter even came out to look at the sparkling sweep of broken windshield glass. If we hadn't witnessed it ourselves, we could have half imagined that the glass was evidence of simple vandalism, and that Angelo would soon be showing up at our side doors with his scuffed-up football clutched in his arm, calling us out for another game of United States street football. The paper story was all about Pete Baroni, who eventually ran aground in the weedy, ambiguous yard of the old farmer and his wife, who at one time had farmed the entire neighborhood before selling it off to developers. The piece of land they were left with was never clearly defined. Did they own the empty field behind the house, the vacant lot next door? All that was certain was that they were dying, or nearly dead, and they were scared out of their minds by the sirens and flashing lights of the emergency vehicles tearing ruts into their weedy yard. I never saw either of them ever again. Pete had nearly killed his girlfriend, Donna Monaco, earlier that afternoon, smashing in her head with a blunt object that was never found, though we all guessed it was a billy club Pete had made in shop class the previous year before he dropped out, a billy club hollowed out and filled with lead. In wood and metal shop at Warren Woods High School, the craft of weapon making was honed and refined under the bleary, bloodshot eyes of Mr. Ernie Cook, who in the imagined privacy of his adjacent office drank himself into oblivion every afternoon. The drunker and or more hungover Ernie was, the more oil he put on his slicked back hair, as if he just oiled it enough, some would sink through to kickstart his brain, or maybe simply relieve the endless headache of his life. While it's not true that we blamed all our troubles on the blacks from Detroit, they were a convenient target since none of us actually knew any black people. Our neighborhood was 50% Polish Catholic and 50% Southern redneck, 100% white. All the rumbles in our neighborhood, brutal as they were just scrimmages for the battles with blacks we imagined having, though they never took place. Borders were respected. While we imagined they were threatening to cross 8 Mile Road and invade our neighborhood, in reality, we had little they would have wanted. The one place where the races mixed was at the factory, and according to our fathers, even there, the departments were segregated. Pete had claimed he'd made the club to hit the random black people who might inadvertently stray across 8 Mile, but he'd ended up using it on Donna. Donna, one of the most beautiful, dark-eyed foxes to ever sashay the sidewalks of Warren. I cringed, imagining her destroyed face as she lay in a coma at Marigold Hospital. Angelo dead and Donna Monaco vegetized, all because Pete Baroni'd found out that Matt Ropp drove her home from a high school dance while Pete was pumping gas at Davy's 8 Mile brake service. "Man," I said to my brother Steve, "why can't Pete just back his car up all the way to his house and it could still be third down?" Steve was 10. I was 13. "Transmissions problems," Steve said. the one thing we all knew was about cars, how they worked, how they didn't work, what kind we were going to drive someday. We had already stopped riding bicycles, thinking they were made for little kids, though for at least a couple more years we had no alternative except to walk, or to hope some older guy would take mercy on us, which Pete had done on many occasions, letting a gang of us pile into his Firebird and cruise the streets and smoke cigarettes, giving us that harsh burn in our throats we associated with getting older.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Jim Ray Daniels, and he's reading in part from his collection of stories, Mr. Pleasant. You know, Jim, Detroit obviously is a lot in your stories. I know that's where you're from. Pittsburgh is, too. And then that stretch of highway in Ohio, that flat stretch of highway between Detroit and Pittsburgh. But especially from the selection that you read, I was wondering, you know, how I know you go back. You've said you go back to Detroit a lot, but I think it's I guess what I'm trying to get at is when you live in a city, you are attuned to kind of the nuances of how it changes over time. And then there's also like your hometown, the place where you're from. And if you move away from that, when you're writing about Detroit, how has that changed for you over time? Because it is where you're from, but you haven't lived there for a long time. The city has changed. You've lived in here in Pittsburgh in a city that's changed a lot too over that time. Like, how do you negotiate all that in your work? Is it easy? Is it hard?
Well, in a way, I think it's easier because I'm not there having the reality of it stare me in the face. So it's a place in my imagination, in a way. My previous book before Mr. Pleasant was called Detroit Tales. Mm-hmm. And I got an email from somebody who said, well, this isn't the Detroit that I know. And I said, of course it's not the Detroit that you know. It's my Detroit. You have your Detroit, and everybody has their own versions of where they're from. As a writer, I tend to take comfort in the words of Richard Price, who's a novelist, and he's written some great scripts and things that I really admire. He said, where you're from is like the zip code of your heart. And that it's my interpretation of that is that it's always with you. No matter where you go, you carry, you know, home with you.
Right.
And I've been fortunate enough in that Pittsburgh is similar enough in various ways to Detroit. And I think it's hard to generalize it about an entire population, but it feels very comfortable. It has always felt very comfortable for me here. And in some stories, quite frankly, I've turned Detroit into Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh into Detroit, depending on what seemed right for the individual story.
Sure. You know, I think what's hard, especially when you move away from the place, and like you're saying from the quote from Price, that it is the zip code of your heart, you can start to make it seem softer than the reality of it was. Do you have to watch yourself on that? Do you particularly pay attention to that, or do you just let it flow and see what happens?
No, I think that's a good point, because writers can get sentimental and nostalgic and sort of idealize and smooth off the rough edges of where they're from. So I'm aware of that, that I'm trying to do something. And I think about it particularly in the revision process, because there is a certain satisfaction in just kind of getting something down that something triggers a memory and you recount it and maybe expand on it and turn it into fiction, but still there's often the seed of something real and it feels good. There's a comfort, I think, to go back there. So I have to ask myself, what's in the story for somebody outside of this world? Am I bringing them into the world enough to hopefully, you know, get them to care about it a little bit, because I don't want it to be kind of insular or private in some way.
Sure. Well, and I can see where, you know, your stories and your relationship when you write about Detroit or Pittsburgh or any of the landscapes you write about, that you're giving it more flesh. You know, I think in particular with recent economic the things that have gone on with our economy, the nation kind of feels like they can put their finger on what Detroit is. It's that place where they make cars and they didn't adjust their technology enough. And it becomes really this stereotype where you're really talking about people and landscape and jobs and, you know, more than that.
Yeah. And the thing I think a lot of people don't realize about Detroit is that Detroit's been hurting for a long time. So in the early 80s, during the recession, during the Reagan years, the auto industry was really hurting then and never recovered completely. So this current recession is similar in many ways. It's cutting deeper, but I think I'm trying to, you know, resist and fight against a lot of stereotypes, as all writers do.
Sure.
I think there are stereotypes of Detroit. There are stereotypes of the working class that I want to work against and individualize these writers or these people, these characters in the book. So, for example, in the title story that I'll read some of shortly, Mr. Yeah. Pleasant, the main character, he goes away to college because other people have this idea of success. You go away to college and you improve yourself and you escape the, you know, working class life. But he actually drops out of school and goes back there. And that's not a horrible thing for him, it turns
right.
out.
Well, that's a great setup, Jim. How about you you read a little bit for us?
Sure. The premise of the story, Mr. Pleasant, is that there's a city in Michigan called Mount Pleasant, where Central Michigan University is at. And that's where the main character is going to college unsuccessfully, but he's there during the story. And when he was a kid, he looked at the map, and because of the abbreviation MR period, or MT period, he read that as Mr. Pleasant instead of Mount Pleasant. And that's one of the ideas that shows up here at the beginning of the story. Mr. Pleasant. Robin and I stood together in her tiny kitchen, our jeans slouching into each other in front of the rusty sink. She lived in an apartment above an abandoned storefront on Main Street in Big Rapids. There are no Big Rapids in Big Rapids, Michigan, just as there are no mountains in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. At that moment, I couldn't remember her name. I kept thinking Sue, though I knew it was wrong. I closed my eyes for a minute, hoping it would come to me. When I was a child, I misread the map and thought the town was Mr. Pleasant. I was sorely disappointed when I discovered the truth, yet not enough to keep me from moving there to attend college at Central Michigan University. Maybe I was still hoping I'd find a Mr. Pleasant who'd be willing to cut me some slack. It was the only place that accepted me with my 2.1 GPA. It must have been that 0.1 that got me in, that A in outdoor chef my junior year. I was determined to get away from Detroit, and if it took college to get me there, so be it. The old man was paying. "We are leaving now, Red," Matt Rumberg said. He stood behind me, his wife Jen behind him. I called them the Glumbergs, for despite their willingness to go anywhere and do anything, they seemed unwilling to enjoy themselves, particularly when they were together. I was nicknamed Red for obvious reasons. My real name was Tim. Matt was my second cousin, and they needed help paying the rent, so I was living in their spare room. We'd driven out together on our friend Sam's promise of a good party. 2 hours is a long way to drive just for a good party. But we were tired of the central scene, and we hadn't seen Sam since he graduated the previous spring. He was now, to everyone's amusement, a drug counselor in Big Rapids. This was before all the drug testing, so you pretty much had to believe what people told you, and I still think that's the way it should be. Sam could counsel anybody on drugs. I opened my eyes. Her name was Robin. "Okay," I said, turning quickly back to her. Believing in a Mr. Pleasant, perhaps it was that kind of faith that allowed me to let my friends abandon me in Big Rapids, despite having no ride back to Mount P. I'd never slept with a Robin before. I was nearly finished shredding my last semester at Central. I blamed it on living on West Center Street. There was no plain old Center Street in Mount Pleasant, and that's where I needed to be.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Jim Ray Daniels. So you've turned some of your work into film. Can you talk a little bit about that, from the how that feels to take something from one page and put it into bodies and movement?
Well, it's a real challenge, because one of the things that you can, you know, hear from those excerpts, and I write a lot in the first person. I write a lot where I'm just getting into the characters' heads all the time. And one of the things about film is you can't get into characters' heads. There's no thought balloons. You know, it's just everything has to be in dialogue and what the actors bring to it. So one of the big things is that it's a huge collaborative process. So as opposed to sitting in a room by myself, when we're making the films, we have obviously the director, John Rice, who this is the third film I've worked with him on. So we're pretty in tune with where we're trying to go with these films. And then, you know, there's the actors, the cast and crew, everybody brings to it something different. And I actually get stimulated by the creative process, the collaborative process, because when other people are good at what they do in a creative environment, that just is a challenge to me to make my words worth it for them in a way. But yeah, I have to take out all the thoughts and try and find ways to externalize them and to trust the director and the actors to bring out some of the things that that aren't in words, that you can't use words to like you can in a story.
Do they read your story or just the script?
They often read the story because I think particularly the leads, I want to give them a sense of what's going on in the character's head. So the two leads in Mr. Pleasant, Red and Robin, I sent them both a copy of the story.
One of the things I'm interested in, because one of the things I really like about your stories, this is one of my little pet peeves, and it's both in stories and film, is when I see a writer kind of raising questions, let's say in character, by issues of character, and then they get to the end of the piece and they have to find a way to end it, so they end it with plot. You know, some, you know, the world explodes or some big giant plot point happens. Yeah. And that kind of drives me a little nuts because I'm so engaged by what's happening with the character. And you have a really kind of even balance in the way that you manage that in your stories. You know, for one thing, we've got these kind of, except in Pittsburgh, these flat landscapes. Mm-hmm. So the characters really, you know, even physically, if you imagine them, kind of stand out in the landscape, because if you're a flatlander like me, there's nowhere to hide. There's no mountains.
Exactly.
And so there's these issues that are kind of stirring in them. You're talking about this kind of, you know, internal life. And what you don't do is just go for that, you know, the world blows up at the end. It really resolves itself in something that feels very well managed. And I mean that as a compliment. But with film, that's got to be trickier.
Oh, yeah. With the last two films, the previous one was called Dumpster. Basically, I say, well, there's no plot. I mean, they're very character-driven pieces. Not a lot happens. And on film, such a visual medium, it's a risky thing. So I just keep creating problems for John, the director, because the last one, Dumpster, half the film, there's two characters in a dumpster. And the new one, with Mr. Pleasant, a majority of the story takes place in cars.
Yeah.
So just characters sitting in cars. How do you make that visually interesting?
Do you find that by working in film now, is it changing the way you're writing stories at all? Are you thinking more in that visual way, or is it just kind of confirming the way you've been writing, but you try to pick stories then if you move into the visual project that you think will work better?
Yeah, it was John's idea to work with Mr. Pleasant. He wrote me a note. He was rereading the book and suggested, oh, how about this one? But I think as a writer, when I go back to writing fiction, if anything, I pay more attention to dialogue, because dialogue in film has to be even tighter than dialogue on the page. I mean, dialogue in general has to be tight, but I find in film just being ruthless about snipping off every little extra word that I can. Because people are looking at something, and if they're just looking at a talking head, that gets kind of boring after a while.
Yeah, and I think there has to be a crispness to the dialogue, too. It's one of the things I know, I notice on murder mysteries or something on television, they narrate all the time. Like, here, we know that he was related to this woman, and that's the reason why she showed up, and they, give you all these external things. So it just becomes very, plot narration. And I think really good films resist that. You know, they try to bring the audience along with them, but it's not just telling you, and here's what happened, and then this happened, and then this, because that's not the way we talk.
No. Yeah, I could probably use a little bit more plot in some of my pieces. But as a writer, as a poet, as a screenwriter, as a fiction writer, I'm always interested in the small things that people walk by and say, oh, there's no poetry there, there's no story there. Finding it in the small everyday things has been one of my, you know, consistent things as a writer across the genres. And I think it partly does come from my background in that, in my, you know, neighborhood, in my community back in Detroit, which consisted mostly of auto workers, there was a sense of, well, there's no literature in these people's lives. And I've always wanted to say, hell yeah, there is. And, you know, you just have to slow down and look a little harder.
Yeah. How about you read a little bit more for us?
Okay, great. So I'd like to read from a story that will be in a new collection, A Trigger Man. This is from a story called Candy Necklace. And I do need to set it up a little bit.
Sure.
The main character is Shelley. She's a 14-year-old girl who lives with her alcoholic mother and her sister, Tina. And she had to take her mother to the emergency room of the hospital because she cut herself on a broken liquor bottle. And she's only 14, but she drove her mother to the emergency room. And she doesn't have her license. She really doesn't know how to drive. And her mother's groggy with the drugs they gave her. So she talks an orderly in the hospital into driving them home. And this is them as they arrive back at their house, to taking them home after the ER visit. "Turn here," Shelley said. "And this is your street?" Mike said. Shelley hadn't thought much about where they lived. It was just home. They had a tiny two-bedroom house. Stoney, her father, had paid cash for at a time when their lives resembled the normal lives Shelley saw on TV, except that no one ever paid cash for a house. Stoney is a drug dealer, an absent drug dealer. The street was littered with empty lots where houses had once stood, where no one would ever build again. To Shelley, the weedy lots were just part of the landscape, like someone who lost teeth through no fault of their own. "You're getting me down, Mike Torres," she said. "This is the house right here. I'm just saying, look, I forgot your name. I'm just saying this is no picnic grove you're living in." It hit her hard that he had not remembered her name. She put her hand on the door handle. "Shelley," she said, "my name is Shelley. You don't need to tell me about where I live." She had not cried in years, but she felt like she was going to. The car stopped and she yanked the handle and slammed the door shut, then opened up the back seat to pull her mother out. Behind her, Mike Torres gently touched her shoulder. "Let me get her. I do this for a living." He lifted her up and she roused her head. "Who the heck are you?" Ginger asked. "Mike Torres," he said. "I'm a nurse who's helping you get back home." He opened his coat to reveal his blue scrubs. Shelley envied the clarity of that statement. She wanted to say, "I am Shelley Reed. I'm someone who's doing something." Even if it was a lie, even if it was only true for a few seconds. Ginger seemed to accept Mike, taking his hand as he guided her to the door and inside, while Shelley led the way, unlocking the door with her mother's key and holding it open for them. Inside, the broken bottle and the trail of blood and the smell of whiskey hit her all at once. It made Shelley want to vomit, but she swallowed hard and quickly led Mike to Ginger's bedroom, where he slipped her gently onto the unmade bed. "Thank you, young man," Ginger said. She turned her head to the wall and closed her eyes again. Shelley heard laughter coming from the room she shared with Tina, her sister. She slipped across the hall and cracked the door open. Tina was in bed with Eddie, the guy who drove her to school. Tina looked up. "What the hell, Shelley? Is Mom okay?" "You mean you got my phone message? Well, why didn't you come?" Tina looked at Eddie. Eddie laughed. Shelley slammed the door on them. Mike stood at the house at the door of the house, jangling his keys. "Gotta run, girl," he said. She looked at him. "Shelley," he said, and smiled. Shelley suddenly pushed herself forward and into his arms, wrapping them around the leather jacket, squeezing hard as he tried to pull away, squeezing until he gave in and hugged her back. "Don't go," she mumbled into the soft leather of his jacket. "You gotta let me go," he said. "I'm sorry." "Kiss me, Mike Torres," she said, turning her face up toward his. "I'm going to be cleaning up whiskey and blood and glass as soon as you leave." "Girl," he said, "girl." He pushed her away and hurried out the door, then drove away. Mike Torres had a tattoo of Gandhi and Jesus on his arm. Shelley had heard the name Gandhi before, but didn't really know who he was. If he was high-fiving Jesus, he must have been somebody important, though it looked like he was wearing a diaper in that tattoo. She didn't know a heck of a lot about Jesus either, except for Christmas and Easter. She was a little murky on what happened in between. At least Mike Torres had his heroes. Why couldn't he have been hers? Now he was back in the sweet-smelling car, driving away into the thick darkness that had taken her father and her brother. She wanted it to take her, too. She wanted to buy a ticket on darkness and let her take her on a long ride, but she had no currency recognized by night. She had a candy necklace. Her shoe crunched against broken glass. The bright overhead light created garish sparkles off of the ruins. How could Tina just walk right past it? How could she get the phone message from the ER and not call? Shelley felt like she was exploding out of her skin. The two bedrooms were full, and the living room was a crime scene. She had nowhere to go in that tiny house that wasn't tainted. She went into the bedroom and locked the door. She removed her tight shirt and her flimsy bra and stared at herself in the mirror above the sink. She applied more mascara and eyeliner until her eyes were black holes. She rouged her cheeks bright red, but she was still Shelley. She removed her jeans and underwear. Tina was pounding on the door now, and she heard her mother's muffled voice demanding something. She turned on the water to drown out their voices. She pulled the hospital papers out of her purse and folded them into paper airplanes the way her father had taught her once when he was home and she was a child. She creased each document hard against the bathroom tile, then cranked open the window. She lit each piece of paper with her lighter and sent them sailing out into the night to see how far they could travel before turning to ash.
Thanks for coming to Prosody, Jim.
Thank you. It's been great.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment Newsweekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner. Please tune in every Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.